Here's commentator Woody Allen on the latest joke in Washington.
I think it appears originally in Freud's Wit and Its Relation to the Unconscious. And it goes like this, I'm paraphrasing. I would never want to belong to any club that would have someone like me for a member. That's the key joke of my adult life.
Republicans don't want to join President Obama's bipartisan club that is keen to have them as members. The GOP, it's their party, and if they want to, they'll just stay out in the cold. The temperature of bipartisanship, absolute zero on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Daljeet Dhaliwal is in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Daljeet.
Good morning, John.
And we are talking about all kinds of things in this morning's program, particularly GPS, satellites that actually watch you, technology that knows where you are and can tell other people where you are.
Mm-hmm. And first, let's take a look at the headlines.
President Obama will sign the economic stimulus package into law in Denver today. To economist Peter Morici, the plan is a deep-fried hot fudge sundae with Mountain Dew-flavored ice cream, whipped cream on top, and garnished with chocolate-covered bacon and brown sugar. Believe it or not, that's a negative in the world of economics.
We can give the economy a sugar high by spending too much money,
do we go to
basically
Asia?
Borrowing it through a stimulus package. But as Paul Krugman pointed out, once the stimulus money is spent, then what? The answer is we sink back down.
Krugman watches sweets, so does Peter Morici. The White House disagrees with all of this. They say it will create jobs that boost the economy. The president will promote the stimulus package in trips to Colorado and Arizona, deftly choosing states known more for lean meat and healthy taco salads. U.S. automakers are due to slim up. Today is the deadline to explain their plans to pay back billions in government loans. Tough talks have gone on with the auto workers union. Carmakers want help from the union to save money. The deadline is today. Daljeet?
Some 20,000 California state workers, John, could lose their jobs. The state government is nearly broke, facing a $42 billion budget deficit. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says that layoff notices could go out as soon as today. Tense negotiations on a new budget have stalled. A landmark trial is underway in Cambodia. At the center is a Khmer Rouge jailer. He ran a prison where some 16,000 people were tortured and killed, including children. This is the first Khmer Rouge trial for a Cambodian special tribunal. About 1.7 million people died during the late 1970s rule of the Khmer Rouge. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is in Asia making military deals and speaking out on North Korea. A new agreement will move 8,000 American troops off a Japanese island. She's also criticizing talk of a North Korean missile test. She says North Korea could get aid if it abandons nuclear weapons.
Nothing sweet going on Wall Street today. It took yesterday off, of course, for the President's Day holiday, but the Dow starts today at 7850. The S&P kicks off at 826, and so far the futures market shows a significant downturn at the opening about 90 minutes from now. In the New York Times, it's a look at GPS technology in your iPhone or whatever phone that you have. Cell phones know where you are. Your girlfriend, your boss, your editors, they could all know where you are with the new technology that you can download to your phone. How do you think tracking people might help out in your life? It's been around in business for quite a while. But for consumers, call us at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Daljeet Dhaliwal is in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Daljeet.
Good morning, John.
Now, so, got a word for you.
Yeah.
Bipartisanship.
Let me guess.
As Woody Allen said there at the top of the hour.
And that was the word that kept coming up. In fact, it was every, second or third word that came out of every candidate's mouth. It was bipartisanship.
Yes. And, you know, as Woody Allen said, the GOP apparently doesn't want to be a member of a club that would have it as a member, especially if it's Democrats who are inviting them in. Well, what do we say about bipartisanship today? The first word you might say is delusional.
We're happy that Congress, in a bipartisan way, took steps to make whatever happens in this recession easier to take for the American people.
What is Press Secretary Robert Gibbs talking about there? The other word on bipartisanship, you might say, is scolding.
There's a time for quibbling, and there's a time for coming together. This was a time President Obama reached out to a large number of people. This was a time to come together. And, you know, I am disappointed.
That's Senator Charles Schumer of New York talking about how disappointed he is that Republicans didn't cross the aisle and vote for the stimulus package, except for three senators, no one in the House. So bipartisanship, what would we call this?
I know bipartisanship when I see it. I've participated in it. I've gone back home and gotten primary opponents because I wanted to be bipartisan. There's nothing about this process that's been bipartisan. This is not change we can believe in.
That, of course, is Republican Senator Lindsey Graham speaking over the weekend about bipartisanship. Does it even exist? Well, you need to be an archaeologist to find it in Washington these days. And joining us now is, I guess you wouldn't call her an archaeologist, really. Julie Mason is White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, which is a free daily newspaper in Washington, D.C. She joins us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Julie, thanks for being a part of the program.
Good morning, John. I'm happy to be here.
Now, it sounds like Lindsey Graham is saying that the Democrats, froze out the Republicans. Is that a fair statement in your view of the events over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, they sure did. Bipartisanship sounds good. Voters like it. They like to Republicans and Democrats both like to talk about it all the time. But when it comes right down to it, Democrats won these last elections. They won them and big, and they don't feel like being partisan. When they talk about being bipartisan, what they really mean is Republicans need to capitulate. So in terms of succeeding in President Obama's promises to be bipartisan, this first outing on the stimulus bill was just a failure.
Of course, the Democrats' version, and I suppose if you put the scolding of Chuck Schumer aside there about how disappointed he is, they're suggesting that this is a strategic decision on the part of the GOP, particularly in the House, to basically keep their fingerprints off any of this stimulus business, because in 4 years, it's believed that the economy is still going to be in a pretty bad situation, and in 2 years, it certainly will be, and the House is all has to run again. So they're going to run on a message of not our fault.
Exactly. You know, the Republicans massacred.
You agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. Republicans got massacred in this last election. They're looking for some issues to rebuild their party on. And Barack Obama gave them a Christmas present in this huge spending bill that for them, it's ideologically consistent to oppose this bill. Republicans, not in recent history, but, in building their party, being against big spending was something that they really believe in. So this was easy for them to oppose. And like you say, their calculation was the economy is not going to turn around in 2 years by 2 years from now when most of us have to run. So there's really nothing to lose in opposing this.
I guess, my ultimate question is, does government work better when bipartisanship happens? I mean, who cares about bipartisanship? Does better legislation, better policy get made when Republicans and Democrats are smiling at each other?
Well, there is a very strong strain of cynicism among those who believe that bipartisanship is a little silly and it's better for the government to be in gridlock because the less they do, the better the country is.
Well, I guess if the alternative to bipartisanship is gridlock, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But other people would say that the alternative to bipartisanship is a clarity of a mandate and a single party, a single sort of author producing legislative change. Maybe it doesn't work out, but at least it's clear. It's not gridlocked because things are getting passed by a majority.
Maybe so, but if you're out of that majority, if that majority doesn't represent your views, then I don't think you would support that. It's interesting. In Congress, there really aren't that many moderates anymore. So the country has gotten more partisan, as people have become more divided, Congress reflects that. So it's interesting that so many people, when you ask them, they say, well, I want Congress to work in a bipartisan fashion, when they themselves are so partisan for the most part. So it's interesting to watch this dynamic play out. And really, politicians talk about bipartisanship more than normal people do. They're the ones who push this issue. Obama, for example, I would argue that he raised the bar on bipartisanship and promised, maybe perhaps overpromised, what he would be able to do in terms of bringing both parties together.
So, Julie, if you see it that way, then why this pretense towards bipartisanship? I mean, what does it add to the national dialogue?
Well, it's very, again, it's very politically popular. When pollsters go out and they ask people, you know, do you believe in this? Do you think the parties should work together? Very strong response. Yes, the parties should work together. So it's something that politicians talk about a lot, but it's something they find very hard to do. Reagan had great success.
Well, let's talk about Reagan in a moment, but I just want to go back on that. When people ask pollsters, when pollsters ask that question, that everyone likes bipartisanship, it reminds me of like when you ask parents, you know, you prefer that your kids not fight. Of course, you prefer that they don't fight, but you're not gonna get rid of them. It seems like such a poorly phrased question.
Well, again, I do think there's a bit of a backlash developing to this notion of bipartisanship. We heard Nancy Pelosi in the final throes of the stimulus bill sort of shrugging it off and saying, you know, bipartisanship, that's a process argument. We're working here. This is work.
Well, let's talk
so
process.
That might be an emerging theme.
You mentioned Reagan, and that's a really important point because there was divided government during the entire 8 years, if I'm not mistaken, of the Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. And a lot of important policy got passed, even though there was a sense rhetorically that gridlock was going on. What do you think was the key in making the Reagan administration period work? And again, that was a recession in the early 80s.
Right. Reagan came in with a terrible economy, just like Obama, and he was able to get his tax cuts passed in part by really horse trading with the Democrats and allowing them to turn his bill into, they called it a Christmas tree. They could put their pet projects right on his tax cuts, and then it went through. But now, in the current political climate, you know, earmarks are second perhaps only to lobbyists as public enemy number one. And that's another situation that politicians have created by demonizing earmarks and demonizing lobbyists. So now they weren't able to do that with this bill. There really was not a lot of horse trading. There was a little bit. Republicans were able to add some of the tax cuts that they wanted onto Obama's bill, but really nothing like the scale we saw during the first Reagan term.
Do you think things would be different if it wasn't a two-party political system, if there were a third player, a third national player in American politics? I mean, would that sort of ease things up, and could we really talk then about being truly bipartisan?
It's hard to see. First of all, I don't think the two parties would ever allow a third party in. I mean, they're just so powerful, and then these third parties just have such a hard time getting traction. But I think that actually might muddy the argument. I mean, more voices are always better, and a more robust argument is better than one party just marshaling everything through. But it's hard to imagine that that would be a more effective system.
And I guess bipartisanship looks a lot like one party. if the two parties don't have a difference, then what is the point of even a two-party system? Well, before we go, I want to sort of reiterate the point that you just made in that the earmarks that have been so trashed by both parties in this election amount to a kind of currency that actually allows bipartisanship to work. If you talk about the Reagan example, he allowed earmarks, which is why the deficit spiked so much during the Reagan years. But when John McCain says get rid of pork, what he's really saying politically is get rid of the currency whereby politics gets transacted in Washington. Is that what you're saying?
Right. That's a really good point, John. That's exactly what I'm saying. And earmarks and this kind of horse trading, it's gone on for so long. Now they have to think up a new name for it because it's really the way things get done. But in these last few election cycles, the notion of earmarks has really penetrated the public consciousness and it has really become demonized.
Well, that's a spectacular takeaway on this whole question, because I was actually going into this segment going, bipartisanship? I would much rather talk about paint drying than bipartisanship. But it's really interesting. I mean, on the one hand, it's not going to work unless we bring back earmarks or the White House is the opposite party of the majority party in Congress. Is that a fair takeaway here?
That's a very fair takeaway, absolutely. They have to really make some serious trades and really get down to it in order to be truly bipartisan. Just talking doesn't get it done.
All right, Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, with a very interesting take on this notion of bipartisanship. It may not exist, but there are very good reasons why. Julie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, and Julie, are you on GPS, by the way?
No, currently, John.
Do you
expect
care?
To be by the end of the week, though, after
this
show.
Do you care if, like, your relatives or the producers on this program know where you are all the time on your cell phone?
Well, I feel like they do a little bit, but not with GPS. But the whole idea makes me very uncomfortable.
Well, we're going to send one to your editor there, Julie. How's that for you? Thanks so much for joining us. Julie is the White House correspondent. Julie Mason is the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, where she joined us from.
Yeah. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I said during the campaign that Iran is a country that has extraordinary people, extraordinary history and traditions, but that its actions over many years now have been unhelpful when it comes to promoting peace and prosperity both in the region and around the world.
Choice words from President Obama last week in his first official White House press briefing. They showed just how carefully he is treading down the road to diplomatic relations with Iran. And as the president said, Iran has a rich culture, but one that few Americans have been exposed to. Azadeh Moveni spent time in Iran as a Time magazine's Middle East correspondent, and she's written a new book about her experiences called Honeymoon in Tehran, 2 years of love and danger in Iran. We're happy to have her on the program with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is your second memoir about Iran. The first one was Lipstick Jihad. What's changed in Iran since you wrote that book?
Two important things have changed. The first is that the new president, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, came to power in the interim between my first book and my second and recast Iran's relationship with the world and very promptly alienated the majority of the Iranians who had voted for him and otherwise. So Iran is now a very different place than the country I reported and wrote about in my first book. It was then headed by a much more moderate president, President Khatami, so a more alienated and despairing Iran at this moment. And also the young generation is now in their 30s, that sort of baby boom that emerged after the revolution. So you have a sort of 30-something bubble of frustrated young people rather than a 20-something bubble.
And you would have been part of that generation, if you had still been living in Iran. What are their priorities? What things matter to them? I mean, does the Islamic revolution of Khomeini and its values resonate with them at all?
I think it's so profound how alienated they are from the Khomeini legacy. And what really does matter to them right now, and I can attest to this, you know, from my friends and my relatives and my own experiences living there, they need jobs. Real estate is extraordinarily expensive in Tehran. It's such a crisis that young people aren't even able to get married before their mid-30s very often, and that's creating, you know, its own sort of social crises. So really it's the sort of basic opportunities that a society, especially an oil-rich society, should be able to provide its young people are missing here.
And so, what happened to that oil money?
Well, more recently, some of the oil money has been spent, especially during the era of high oil prices. The oil money has been spent compensating for the hits that the Iranian economy has taken because of multilateral sanctions, because of its nuclear program. So the economy is sort of in shambles on its own, and gas and many other sort of basic commodities have been subsidized, but also Iran's sort of poor relations with the world.
Who do ordinary Iranians blame for that? Do they blame Ahmadinejad for not delivering on his promises of putting, bread on the tables of ordinary Iranians, or do they blame the international community?
That's a great question, because I think that about sort of 2 years ago, in the middle of his presidency, he very cannily tried to paint this as the West bullying Iran and creating these sort of harsh economic conditions. But I think that's sort of evaporated, or people's belief in that has evaporated. They see that it's now sort of government mismanagement.
You know, this book, Lipstick, or Honeymoon in Tehran, like your earlier book, is a great travelogue in addition to being a pretty interesting sort of exploration of policy and the relationship of the two countries. But the thing that I'm struck by, particularly in this latest book, Honeymoon in Tehran, is how we get to go along with you in a country that is so full of rich tradition and a confidence about its place in history, a real sophistication about what's going on in the world. I mean, Iranians know more about America than Americans know, it seems to me. When do you think that sense of Iran, what has to happen for that sense of Iran as this sophisticated, almost cosmopolitan place to get out to Americans who still view Iran in the umbrella of Khomeini?
Well, I think that if there's a re-election of another moderate leader in Iran, that will make a great contribution. Because in the era of Mohammad Khatami, who started this dialogue of civilizations and tried to recast America's image in the West, I think that started to sort of creep into the American consciousness. But I think also if there's a president in Washington who's willing to acknowledge those aspects of Iran that you described, that will be important too, because we haven't had that for the most recent.
And Ahmadinejad does have competition because Khatami, who is a moderate and a reformer, is going to run. I mean, what kind of platform would he run on, and what are the chances that he'll actually be able to unseat Ahmadinejad?
When I was there in December and the candidates were running polls, it was likely that he would win very soundly 2-1. Those were what the polls were running in December. He will likely run on a platform of improved relations with the West, of rapprochement, and I think that he'll try and make a lot of economic promises because that was missing in his tenure, and that was what he was criticized for. So I think that he'll try and revive the sense of him being able to make a difference on the economy as well.
And there is a possibility for the first time in many, many years that, you know, there could be a dialogue between Washington and between Tehran. Who should the United States be talking to in this sort of myriad of what is kind of, you know, known as kind of Iranian politics? It's very hard to actually kind of fathom, you know, what happens and, you know, who's actually really pulling the levers of power. I mean, the real power, I guess, is still very, very firmly concentrated in the hands of the clerical leadership.
Khamenei, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. The Supreme Leader Khamenei. It has been a bit of a dilemma in the past, but I think that the experiences, especially with the Afghan War and with the Iraq War, have sort of shown that ultimately, ultimate say on questions like that, Iran-U.S. relations, will be determined by the Supreme Leader. So the U.S. will engage with the foreign ministry and with the elected government, but whatever is discussed will have to sort of go back to the Supreme Leadership for approval.
Azadeh Movini, thank you very much for your insights and good luck with your book, Honeymoon in Tehran. And now here's Femi with the headlines.
Hello there, Dalji. Hey. 29 minutes past the hour. It's taking me back a few years. I haven't said hello to you for ages. 29 minutes past the hour is the time. Stocks in Europe fell sharply today. Major Asian markets finished down as well. We'll see if Wall Street follows suit. It opens today for a short trading week after the President's Day holiday. Dow futures are down around about 2% right now. Is that right, John? You're checking?
Yes, I'm checking. It looks about 2% at this point.
Checking up on me. President Obama will sign his $787 billion stimulus plan into law today. It'll take place at Denver's Museum of Nature and Science, where the president will tour a solar panel installation there. The stimulus plan includes funding for new energy-saving technology. And Illinois Senator Roland Burris says that he won't step down. He's come under fire about his contact with the brother of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. He released an affidavit over the weekend saying that he spoke about fundraising prior to his appointment. And that's a quick look at some of the headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I don't know about you. I have this really uncomfortable feeling that I'm being watched. that I'm being stalked. And in fact, of course, it's truth. It's reality. It's not some sort of psychological neurosis. My cell phone knows where I am, which means my wife, my girlfriend, my boss, all my coworkers can know where I am. GPS is following all of us, and the technology, as it becomes ubiquitous, could transform our lives. What do you think about that? Let us know what you want GPS phones to do for you. Tell us your ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. A lot of people suspicious of the technology. Daljeet?
Did you say that your wife and your girlfriend know where you are?
I didn't say girlfriend. I don't have a girlfriend.
All right, just kidding.
Yes,
all right.
Their GPS is in cars, you know.
Well, listen, we know that it is a big day for GM and Chrysler. Today, of course, is the deadline for them to present their restructuring plans and to give details on how they're going to repay billions in government loans. Well, auto workers also want to know because the union is in the middle of working out a deal on the cost of retirees' health care. GM alone spends $5 billion a year on health care. To put that in perspective, the company lost $20 billion just last year. Nick Bunkley is working the story for our partner, the New York Times. And Nick, the good morning to you, first of all.
Good morning.
The details of the plan are still under wraps. Give us a sense of, you know, whether they're going to be how to make or break these plans. These are.
Well, that's right. These plans are certainly being closely guarded. We're waiting them to be submitted at some point later today, probably this afternoon, around when the markets will be closing. And you know, they're certainly going to have a lot in them that are going to give an idea not only to people within the company, the workers, the executives, and then the people outside the company, the bondholders, the creditors, you know, everyone that GM and Chrysler owe lots of money to, and of course that includes taxpayers at this point. We're going to get a great idea of so what's ahead in the next few years, and the goal of the plans, of course, is to show that these companies can be viable.
And people in Detroit are also going to be watching this very closely, right?
Right. It's one of these days that at least those of us covering the industry have sort of had circled on our calendars as a day that's really going to give the best idea in quite a long time as to what we're up against. And there's a lot of interest, I think, just among people in this area who, you know, these companies have a lot to do with their daily lives, even if they don't work directly for them. And we're going to find out, you know, what's ahead, how much more pain is coming in terms of job cuts and plant closings. There may be a couple of mentions of those, as well as just what else they need to do to get their costs in line and make sure that they don't run out of money, even with these billions in loans from the government.
If, you know, if there is a risk that this, you know, the money doesn't come through or it's a lot less than the automakers had expected, what kind of impact would this have on a place like Detroit?
Well, it's already had such a big impact on Detroit. Certainly anything more that happens here is just going to add to that. Obviously, you know, home values around the country are suffering, but especially in Detroit, and it's been happening for a number of years, even longer than really anywhere else. And, of course, there's been you know, so many thousands of jobs that have just gone away over the years, both hourly jobs in factories as well as some pretty high-paying jobs, white-collar jobs at technical centers and the company's headquarters. We have a story today about many of the white-collar workers that voluntarily left Chrysler a couple of months ago with a buyout package, but are now, of course, facing the type of market that you really just don't want to be looking for a job in at this point.
And the union's also in the middle of working out a deal on the cost of retirees' health care. Talk to us a little bit about that. I mean, how is that likely to play out?
Right. Retiree health care is the big issue at this point in the negotiations that are ongoing this week with GM and Chrysler and the UAW. The retiree health care costs have just been such a big burden on these companies, as you mentioned earlier. And as part of the contract that the UAW signed with these companies 2 years ago, they came up with a plan to sort of shift those costs away from the companies into this big fund called Aviva. And the issue now, though, is getting billions of dollars into that fund. And, of course, the companies just don't have the money to commit to what they did even just less than 2 years ago.
Nick, it seems to me that with Toyota reporting that it can't make a profit in the U.S. market, that I just can't imagine that there's any way that General Motors can show itself to be viable by any sort of traditional textbook economic means. There's going to have to be a political accommodation to get them to the finish line here, don't you think?
Well, right. Certainly the numbers at Toyota have, I think, opened up a lot of eyes. And you know, no one wants to see any company, of course, losing billions of dollars, but I think people here are pointing to that in a lot of cases to show that, you know, it's not just Detroit in this case. There's always been, for you know, decades, sort of the feeling that Detroit is just out of date and doesn't know what it's doing, and when you look at the numbers coming out of some of these other automakers, it certainly shows that it's not just Detroit this time. But then, given that the fact that GM especially and Chrysler are in such a terrible financial shape, there will need to be some consideration for how they can, in the midst of this market that's affecting everyone, make some sort of effort to recover and get their costs in line in a time when really no one is buying cars.
All right, Nick Bunkley, auto industry writer for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you very much for joining us. And Femi's here again.
Hello. Hey. Don't sound so disappointed.
No, I'm not.
Just because you got away from me for a few years.
I'm so thrilled to pieces.
Payback time, Daljit Dalawar. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, all. President Obama signs the economic stimulus bill into law today in Denver. The $787 billion plan aims to reinvigorate the economy and create jobs. One vote, that could be what stands between 20,000 California state employees and losing their jobs. A new budget fell one vote short of passage in the state legislature, and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says that 20,000 public sector jobs could be cut if lawmakers can't make a budget deal. A new report from the United Nations says that accidental civilian deaths caught in the line of fire in Afghanistan rose nearly 40% last year. Militants were responsible for most of those deaths, but the US, NATO and Afghan troops were responsible for many as well. And that's a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Observers of the political situation in Russia often conclude that Russians, the Russian people, the voting Russian public, above all else, values stability in its government. And that possibly in part explains the popularity recently of Vladimir Putin, who's currently the prime minister. President Medvedev is technically running the country, but it's an all-Putin show, according to Russia watchers. But the question of stability in Russia has really been questioned by the current economic crisis. And if economic trends continue in Russia, it's conceivable that Vladimir Putin's star might be falling in the perception and regard of the Russian people. To get more on this, I'm talking with Stephen Eek, BBC Russian analyst in London. Stephen, what is the possibility that economic trends might actually erode what seems to be an indelible sort of burnish of Russian leader Vladimir Putin?
Well, good morning, first of all. The situation with the Russian economy is actually extremely serious now. Just for a little bit of illustration, 500,000 Russians lost their jobs in December. The national economy in Russia is expected to go into recession for the first time during the current quarter since 1998. And the national currency, the Russian ruble, has lost something like a third of its value since August last year. At the same time, the Russian government is spending hundreds of billions of dollars of its reserves trying to prop up the ruble and big parts of industry. So far, if you look at the opinion polls, neither President Medvedev nor Prime Minister Putin seem to be much affected by this, although in their public remarks over recent weeks, they are starting to give the first signs of nervousness. Now, what they've said is that, yes, there are serious economic problems, but they're taking anti-crisis measures. In a large part, they're still attempting to blame the problems affecting Russia on the global situation and occasionally still blaming the Americans directly, saying this all started in the United States and then infected, right, if you like, the rest of the world. But they are showing signs of nervousness.
Well, Stephen, there are two clocks ticking here. One involves the amount of reserves that the Russians have to prop up the ruble, and I wonder how long that can go with oil at this price. And there's a second clock. It's a job clock. It's more complicated. Could you describe both of them?
Yes, certainly. The reserves Russia had until the beginning of the crisis, which in Russia goes back to July or August last year, were the second largest in the world after China. They have spent a very large proportion of them, many hundreds of billions of dollars, on propping up the currency. But despite having done that, it's lost a third of its value. The other problem is, of course, for the state budgets, with oil prices having fallen so low. A lot of the social programs, the programs intended for modernization of infrastructure, have had to be reduced or indeed scrapped. The other question on the job situation, with 500,000 Russians having lost their jobs in December, the big worry now is over unemployment. Unemployment has been traditionally low in Russia, especially over the last 10 years of the economic boom. But the Russians, the Russian officials and the government have actually shown that when strikes start to appear, when there's direct protest by ordinary people, they are actually ready and willing to clamp down on it very hard. In the Russian Far East, there was a demonstration against new taxes on imported cars, which is an important part of the local economy there. Moscow flew paramilitary police to quite violently suppress those demonstrations all the way from Moscow.
Well, it's certainly the case that based on the experience of the Cold War, the Russian people can absorb a lot of pain economically, but a turnaround in Russia would have dire implications for Vladimir Putin. Stephen Eek, thanks so much for joining us. He's a BBC Russian analyst who spoke with us about the situation in Russia from London.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So how much trouble am I in? Listen to me putting my foot in my mouth right here. My cell phone knows where I am, which means my wife, my girlfriend, my boss, all my coworkers can know where I am.
What was I thinking?
What was I? I just read the script like a machine, but thank God you called me on it. My wife said you saved an utterly awkward and scandalous moment there. But it was all to talk about GPS technology and what it's doing to society. We're going to have a discussion about that in just a moment, right after headlines and me sobbing here from Femi, okay?
Hello there, just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. Today is the deadline for GM and Chrysler to give plans to the government on how they would pay back billions in loans. Both automakers have been talking with the United Auto Workers Union. They want concessions from labour to help them reduce costs. There's been a big developing story from Africa this morning. The government of Sudan has reached a tentative agreement with one of the largest rebel groups in Darfur. Now, it's not a peace agreement, but the talks have been productive. Earlier, we spoke to the BBC's Karen Allen in Nairobi for the latest on the talks.
What's been agreed at talks in Qatar between the Justice and Equality Movement, one of the most heavily armed and most active of the rebel groups, and the Sudanese government, is to stop attacks on civilians, to allow humanitarian access to so many of the people who are displaced, and also to begin the process of discussions over a prisoner exchange.
Karen also emphasised that the agreement is not a peace deal, but a positive beginning to further talks that could end the fighting in the Darfur region of Sudan. The conflict has left an estimated 300,000 people dead. And Australian police say the death toll from last week's bushfires is now at 200. They say the number will go up as fire investigators continue their work. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Honey, of course it was an accident. No, I didn't mean to. Oh, sorry. Thank you, Femi.
Don't mention my girlfriend.
That's right. So girlfriends, boyfriends, what are the perils of internet technology involving global positioning system technology? John Markoff, technology reporter for The New York Times, is here. Why is Markoff in the house?
So you mean this map shows
everyone?
Everyone?
Everyone.
Where they are,
what they're doing,
every minute
of every day.
Brilliant.
That's from Harry Potter, but of course we don't have to go to Harry Potter to experience the idea of interactive maps. Courtesy of GPS technology and software you can load onto your iPhone or your BlackBerry, you can actually get a network of friends together and through map iconography, just sort of right there on the map, see where they all are at any given moment. John Markoff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
What are the social implications of this? I loaded it last night. I actually can see where my wife is in the house right now on my iPhone if I want to. It seems like a lovely little diversion, but there's a sinister quality to it, it seems.
Well, of course. I mean, we've been down that road with all the movies we've been watching for decades. I think it's different from yours and my generation, John, and the people who are in their 20s and 30s who are already living pretty much transparently on Facebook and MySpace, and this is a pretty small step for some people.
So the sinister quality is actually a form of naivete on the part of people of my age, essentially.
No, I think that it's a cultural thing. I mean, we're creeped out by it, but I think there is a generation of people who just lives this way.
Well, among that generation who lives this way is people who we are asking to send stories, 877-8-MY-TAKE and mytake@thetakeaway.org, to tell us their experience with GPS and how the technology could be used in a positive way for them. Listen to this.
Hi, this is Peter calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. In our case, we do business applications for sales and field service companies that use sort of souped-up PDAs that already have a GPS in them or another device in the vehicle that people are driving. The companies get to know where they are and can better plan routes, more efficiently service customers, and save money at the same time, which is a good thing because it means that more people can be employed and keep their jobs.
Peter, our listener, makes a great point that FedEx and UPS and all sorts of freight delivery services have been using this technology for years. It's simply making its way into the consumer sector.
That was one of the things that I noticed in the last couple of weeks since I've been here in New York, and I've been living with my iPhone, and it's been helping me get around the subways, is that it changes everything. And I began to think about it in terms of history. And if you remember, it was the graphical user interface and that sort of WIMP interface, the sort of metaphor of the computer desktop, that made the personal computer accessible to masses. And it occurs to me that the map is becoming the same kind of metaphor. It's a very accessible way that makes this device that's a computer in the palm of your hand tremendously useful. And in a way, I mean, neurologists have for a long time understood that devices become extensions of our minds. The blind man and the cane is probably the best example. I think the same thing is happening with the smartphone, cell phone.
So it's a prosthetic. The idea, it's a social prosthetic.
Totally.
That's an interesting idea. Now, it requires, though, and Delgen and I were talking about this earlier on the program, it requires the maintenance of a pretty sophisticated infrastructure. The global positioning system, satellite system in space, is a lot of satellites. It's a lot of infrastructure. I mean, I wonder if, you know, if the economy goes even more south than it is now, if we're going to end up like the movie Brazil, where the satellites have fallen out of the sky and
well,
we have
are
these
falling.
Mystified. They are falling out of the sky.
That's right.
Can we maintain this infrastructure to the extent that society is going to want these devices and applications?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about the infrastructure being there, and it becomes denser and denser. I mean, it's not just GPSs. They can find out where you are simply by triangulating either from the cell towers or from just the millions of Wi-Fi hotspots are all around us. They can get very precise locations. So
that's
just
easy.
Take that as a given.
All right. When you could carry on your iPod, 80 gigs of memory. It was said by some sociologists and psychologists that you could actually hold in your hand, in your pocket, the amount of data that is equivalent to all the photographs that you could take in a lifetime based on the entire history of photography. Once you did that, you suddenly had this archive of your entire life. Now, of course, you can take 3 times, 10 times, 100 times those photos and have all of your albums and everything with you. That there were profound social implications of crossing that threshold. Do you think this social networking, knowing where people are on a real-time basis, crosses another such threshold?
Well, I think that we will come to assume that that's just the air we breathe. I mean, not you and I, maybe, but the people who are sort of comfortable with this will take it for granted that they will look at their phone and they'll notice that their college roommate that they haven't seen for 2 years is having dinner, you know,
but
2 doors away.
What about those folks who aren't comfortable with it, and it isn't like, you know, it's not the air that they breathe? I mean, how would you set their concerns at ease?
Well, can you opt out? Is it easy to opt out?
Yeah, I mean, you turn your phone off. It's not a big deal. When you turn your phone off, your network ceases to know where you are. So on that level, it is possible to disappear. The point is that most people don't.
Don't opt out, right?
And the other point is we began worrying about Big Brother. But now the issue that's interesting to me is Little Brother, and not one Little Brother, but the millions of Little Brothers that are following our trail of cookies. They used to follow it through cyberspace, and now we're leaving the same trail of cookies through geographic space.
You know what this does totally ruin, though? The television series 24. You know, all those scenes where, you know, get a lock, 35 more seconds, we can triangulate. Now it's just, people will look at that in 20 years and go, why didn't he just pull out his cell phone? Well, what an idiot. What's wrong with Jack?
If you had access to the information.
Right.
In theory, I'm supposed to control that, not you.
Does the NSA look at all of this, and can they, without a subpoena, basically figure out what I'm buying, where I'm doing it, and basically send that information to the cops?
Well, remember, the NSA is prohibited by law at looking at what we do. So.
That's a yes, John. Excuse me, I interrupted.
Hard question. It's clear that they have access to that data. That's actually a really good question. So this works one way in a democracy, and it's all good and sort of mellow. What happens if we're not in a democracy? The technology's there, and you know, if you look at Europe in World War II, one thing the Nazis did is they took advantage of the phone registers. So we've created a phone register on steroids, and if we have a different form of government, the technology might be used in a very different way.
Well, something to think about, technology, as we proceed through this century. John Markoff, technology reporter for The New York Times, thanks so much for coming in. So is there anything that GPS phones might be good for? Victor doesn't think so. He sends us an email. I work for a trucking company that put GPS on their trucks. We were told by management that it was just for safety reasons, not to track us. I think that's a lie. My coworkers and I are fighting them with the union. It's a going case. I think there should be new labor laws written to keep up with new technology. Here's another take on that.
I think an excellent use would be for stalking radio announcers who do not agree with you. For instance, if they don't take a strong position against GPS technology for this use.
That's a little scary. My wife is already stalking me for claiming I had a girlfriend earlier in the hour. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And your real takeaway this hour comes from the Motor City.
It's one of these days that those of us covering the industry have sort of had circled on our calendars as a day that's really going to give the best idea in quite a long time as to what we're up against.
It's deadline day for the auto industry, at least for GM and Chrysler. That's Nick Bunkley, who covers the auto industry, writing for our partner, the New York Times. As I mentioned, GM and Chrysler announced how they plan on paying back their $17 billion in federal auto bailout loans and indicate how they're going to use the money that they might get subsequently. We are always on. If you missed anything, check out Nick Bunkley's interview. You can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Daljit Dhaliwal. This is The Takeaway.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. And I don't have a girlfriend, honey, really. I no. My wife, my girlfriend, my boss.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Infrastructure music. Liberace plays all the hits.
I'm working on the railroad all the live long day.
boat to pass the time away.
Well, they've been working on the railroad out in the Bay Area, and the situation is not good. Mass transit systems around the country are in trouble, and the big news is that the stimulus package is probably not going to help them. $787 billion cavalry can't save the subway. Liberace on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
I've been working on the radio. I'm John Hockenberry. Daljit Dhaliwal is in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Daljit.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone. And coming up this hour, we've got a take on the economy from a unique voice, something that you've probably missed in all the din surrounding the stimulus. We'll also give you a special preview of the next Frontline documentary on the economic meltdown. Those stories coming up in just a moment. But first, let's get a check of the headlines.
The economic stimulus officially kicks off today. The president will sign the bill into law at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. He'll also check out the solar panels on the building's roof, but we're thinking he probably will skip the special exhibition on ice there. No need to remind folks of the frozen credit markets. The Daytona 500 got rained out 40 laps from the end over the weekend, but U.S. automakers are looking for sunshine from the feds. Today, GM and Chrysler must submit plans on how they'll fix their businesses and pay back billions in federal loans. You may be wondering why we just mentioned two of the big three. Well, Ford, while it's not rolling in dough, is not seeking big federal loans at this time.
Some 20,000 California state workers could lose their jobs. The state is nearly broke, facing a $42 billion budget deficit. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says that layoff notices could go out as soon as today. Tense negotiations on a new budget have stalled. Overseas, and the main rebel group in Darfur has signed a deal with Sudan's government to have broader-based peace talks. This is far short of a full peace deal, but it could end up as being a step towards one. Hundreds of thousands of people have died in the fighting in Darfur. And coming up in the program a little later on, one of our BBC partners in Africa is going to talk to us about what could possibly come next.
Two quick stories from Asia. Landmark trial now underway in Cambodia. At the center is a Khmer Rouge jailer. He ran a prison where some 16,000 were tortured and killed, including children. The first Khmer Rouge trial for a Cambodian special tribunal. 1.7 million people died during the late 1970s rule of the Khmer Rouge.
And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is warning North Korea not to push the button on a rocket test. Clinton is on a tour of Asia, her first trip abroad as Secretary of State. North Korea recently hinted at testing a long-range missile. Clinton says that Pyongyang could get humanitarian aid if it gives up its nuclear weapons program.
So Wall Street starts in 30 minutes at 8:26. That's the S&P's beginning. It's a story in the New York Times today. GPS technology. Is it going to help out your life if cell phones know where you are?
Good morning. You know, GPS, whatever, I want to be able to look at my cell phone and find my wallet. I'm always misplacing it around the house, and I'd settle for something as relatively low-tech as my cell phone telling me, you know, hot, 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 you're cold, you know.
Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. GPS, threat or menace?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin this hour with a segment we're inaugurating and calling your outtake. It's basically a look at an important story that you may be hearing coverage of on a variety of media outlets, but from a perspective you're only likely to get on this program, The Takeaway. Joining us now to talk about the economic meltdown and the stimulus package, of course, being signed out in Colorado, but really the broader implications of the scale of what's going on in the global economy is Juan Enriquez. He's a best-selling author. He actually wrote one of the most important books on politics, economics, and demographics called The Untied States of America. The beginning of Juan Enriquez's resume. We could spend an hour talking about it, but he's a best-selling author, businessman, academic, managing director at XL Medical Ventures, where he does life science venture capital work. Juan Enriquez joins us from the studio of our partners, WGBH, in Boston. Juan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Well, we were talking out at the TED conference when I was out there a couple of weeks back, and you were laying out the scale of what's going on in the global economy. And one of the metaphors you use to describe the kinds of social implications that comes with what's going on in the sort of huge numbers that are moving across the headlines, you use as a metaphor the Latin American debt crisis in the 1980s. And the people of a lot of countries, when they essentially lost the value of their currency, had to accept a whole range of sacrifices before things turned around. First of all, do you still stand by that metaphor, and what sort of sacrifices are we talking about?
Well, there's a fundamental problem, and that is this country has been invaded by a financial crisis that looks a lot like a cancer. And in the same way as you have to go after cancer with chemotherapy, with radiation, with taking it out with an operation, it's the same thing with debt. We've been over-indebted for years. People have been warning about this for years. Four-fifths of the current government budget is already mandatory spending or spending on the military. And if we don't go after what we call entitlement spending, which is really spending our kids' inheritance and our grandkids' inheritance, we're going to be in really deep problems. I mean, the problem in this economy is this is a debt crisis, not a liquidity crisis, and it is not addressed by more debt.
And the stimulus package does involve more debt because we're basically allowing the Saudis and the Chinese and anyone else who wants to buy treasury bills to finance what we're calling a stimulus package. And you say there are implications for that.
Well, think about how you'd feel if some random person came into your house, took out your checkbook, and started writing checks for anything they can dream up because they want your local town to do better. And then they took your kids' savings out of the bank and started doing the same thing with those. And that's exactly what's happening today. They are loading up this enormous spending bill and putting this enormous debt not only on the government, but on all of us. And let me give you a sense of what this means. We're spending a lot more than we earn, and we've been doing that for years. We've been spending 140% on average of what we earn on houses. And then we've been borrowing against that houses. And then credit card debt has been going up much faster than our incomes have gone up. And the same thing's happening in government. See, a tax cut, John, isn't a tax cut unless if you and I pay less and our kids owe less. Otherwise, it's just a great big deferred loan with a high rate of interest.
It's actually a tax increase because we're going to be paying the taxes later on the interest. So let's look at the scale of some of the numbers here. $787 billion stimulus package costs more than the current price tag of the Iraq war. If you calculate all the debt that's outstanding in questionable so-called toxic assets, it dwarfs the entire size of the global economy. True?
Absolutely right. And there's a second problem, and that is that Wall Street over the last 6 to 10 years has been completely unregulated and acting in an absolutely irresponsible way. And they've created all these monetary instruments that nobody has any control over. Let me give you an idea of the scale of this. There are collateralized debt securities, which are, I promise that I will pay you if the other debtor doesn't pay you. And those have been issued to the tune of about $62.5 trillion. The entire U.S. economy is $14 trillion. The global economy is $55 trillion. But that's not the end of the story. There have been a series of derivatives, which are promises that I will pay you on interest rates, I will pay you on foreign exchange, I'll pay you on this, that, or the other. And those are worth about $655
trillion. $655 trillion.
Right. So that's about 14 times the global economy.
So let me just back you up for 1 second. So the what banks are holding as so-called assets, oh, hey, this is worth something. It's a promise from somebody to pay me back on some instrument, some derivative. All those promises that the banks are using as some sort of asset are actually $655 trillion worth of fiction?
Well, it's not just banks. I mean, the problem is that this is spread so widely throughout the economy. It's in university endowments. It's in insurance companies. It's in private portfolios. I mean, the problem is that we've allowed this stuff to spread like a cancer everywhere. And having over-indebted ourselves, instead of trying to figure out how to devalue these derivatives, how to rein them in, what we're doing is we're adding more debt to this fire. And we've already overspent, right? We can't afford the lifestyle that we've got. And we've actually become a very, very selfish generation. We thought our grandkids were going to pay for this, but now the bill has come due with interest, and we're going to have to pay it.
The principal differences between what's going on now and what went on in the Latin American debt crisis in the 80s, which you have some experience with, is that the dollar is a kind of a reserve currency. It's sort of the universal currency for the entire planet. If the numbers you're talking about start to unwind, we could lose the global reserve currency. If the dollar can't be priced, the reserve currency goes out the window. What happens then?
Well, the last thing empires do is drive themselves into bankruptcy. And it's happened to empire after empire. It's happened to king after king. It happened to Britain, which used to be the reserve currency. If you actually look back at 1902 when Robert Cecil was Prime Minister of Great Britain, Great Britain at that point had the strongest manufacturing, the strongest army, the strongest exports, the strongest currency, the strongest universities. It actually looked a lot like the United States does today. It's not inevitable that the United States have a problem, but we, the spenders, have got to quit spending, and we've got to address this thing. We've got to take our medicine. We've got to have our operation. We've got to take some debt out of the system. And if we don't do that, if we keep trying to play this game of I'll continue spending and I'll continue spending and I'll continue spending, then those who are financing our spending, that at this point are the people who are saving and the people who are exporting, like the Chinese, like the Taiwanese, like the Koreans, like the Singaporeans, are going to quit buying our currency simply because we're going to have to devalue it. We're going to have inflation.
But the yuan can't replace the dollar at this point, the way China is structured politically. So if the reserve currency goes away, how will there be a global world trade? How will world trade be transacted? What will happen?
Well, see, one of the reasons why we are in such a dangerous situation and why this has gotten so far out of balance is precisely because there hasn't been an alternative currency to go to. The European countries, in terms of debt, for the most part, are in worse shape than we are. And people aren't yet about to trust the Chinese central bank with their equivalent of T-bills. So what's been happening is people have been going into things like gold, and you've been watching the price of gold skyrocket. They've been going into a series of other instruments, in part because there hasn't been an alternative to the dollar, and that's what's put us in such a dangerous situation.
And it means we're kind of working without a net here. Well, I guess with all of that sort of dire kind of exposition of the global economy, you're a venture capitalist. I mean, how can you be a venture capitalist if you're essentially looking at this kind of a precipice? It must make you not a terribly popular lunch date.
You know, the odd thing is I'm an optimist, and I'm an optimist because when you look at what actually generates jobs and work and wealth in the United States, about 0.02 of the U.S. economy has been invested in brand new venture-backed startup companies. But that's about 17.8% of U.S. economic output. And when you look at an area like MIT, one zip code has generated companies equivalent to the 13th or 15th largest country in the world. This is where you get your eBays, your Intels, your Home Depots, your Starbucks, your Hewlett-Packards. And there's still masses of entrepreneurs and inventors. And the odd thing today is, as the economy's been melting down, there has never been a more exciting time in science. And we've never seen more better things to invest in.
Wow. Well, that is an optimistic point. And if there is something to invest in, Juan Enriquez will be out there looking for it. He's a best-selling author, businessman, academic, managing director at XL Medical Ventures. Our outtake on the global economic crisis from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Juan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, if you're feeling lost, there's probably nothing that can be done about your mood. But your cell phone could actually find you, courtesy of GPS technology. It's a story in the New York Times exploring GPS technology in cell phones and what it means for society. It may sound a little sinister, but is there a way this technology might be helpful to you?
My name's Karen. If your phone is stolen, then the police can track to where your phone is.
I know where I am, but GPS proving where I was to a court of law, who's going to pay me to develop that?
Hi, my name is Ruth Ross. I'm from New Jersey. Imagine how history would have changed if Moses or Columbus had a GPS.
That's a good one. Let us know what you want GPS phones to do for you. Jim says on our website, one positive use would be for parolees and those on probation to carry a cell if they got near someone who had an order of protection. They could immediately be arrested, and then we could all watch it on TV. My take at thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MY-TAKE. Daljeet?
Thank you very much, John. A developing news story overseas that we're watching about Sudan's war-torn Darfur region, where fighting has claimed the lives of 300,000 people. Word that the Sudanese government has made a deal with rebels that could move the warring parties a little further down the road towards peace. Well, a short while ago, I spoke with the BBC's Karen Allen in Nairobi. I asked her what this deal is, if it's not a formal agreement.
What it is a statement of intent between two sides that haven't really spoken to each other since 2007. What this does, it is a tentative agreement to pave the way for further talks and possibly begin a process of trying to end the Darfur crisis. What's been agreed at talks in Qatar between the Justice and Equality Movement, one of the most heavily armed and most active of the rebel groups, and the Sudanese government, is to stop attacks on civilians, to allow humanitarian access to so many of the people who are displaced, and also to begin the process of discussions over a prisoner exchange. This isn't a peace deal, as I say, but it is a very important development, because what we hope to see in the next couple of weeks is more detailed talks begin, potentially bringing in other sides.
Why now, Karen?
Well, there has been pressure ratcheting up for this particular group to come around the negotiating table with Sudan. Sudan, of course, is dealing with a number of different rebel groups. This is just one of them, but it is the most heavily armed. But also the government of Sudan has come under increasing international pressure to try and cooperate and to try and open dialogue, not least because there is the International Criminal Court, the possibility of them issuing an arrest warrant against Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, for alleged war crimes in Darfur. Now, we don't know exactly when that's going to happen. There is a lot of speculation that it could be by the end of this month. It could even be, if it happens at all, by the end of this week. But certainly the pressure has been ratcheting up on the Sudanese government to try and cooperate and to try and show early indications that they want to talk peace.
So there are still many, many things that could cause this to unravel. I mean, if these underlying issues aren't resolved, and is there a framework to deal with these issues?
At the moment, there isn't. There's history which reminds us that in 2006, when a peace deal was struck with one of the warring factions, with one of the rebel groups, the SLA Manawi faction, they caused massive fragmentation. So it's not an easy process at all. And because there are now so many different rebel groups involved in the Darfur conflict, bringing them around the negotiating table is going to be hard. This
and
is an issue about...
Sorry, I was going to ask you, just why have all of these groups begun to splinter, and do they all want different things?
They all want a piece of power, but the key factors that surround all of this, or the common ground, if you like, is access to political power, representation, but also access to some of the very limited resources in Darfur, particularly access to land and water. It is a complex crisis. There are many rebel groups fighting their own fiefdoms. It's ethnically pretty divided. But I think there is a real sense that now that one of the bigger groups has actually come around the negotiating table with the government of Sudan, that things may be moving forward.
So is this any kind of indication as to whether the parties will be forced at some point to give up their weapons?
At this stage, it's too soon to say. In talks that will happen in the next couple of weeks with the Justice and Equality Movement, the talk of a ceasefire is very much at the front of the cards. Talking about giving up weapons totally at this stage, I think, is jumping the gun, if you excuse the pun. I think really at this stage, it's getting all parties together to begin to start building a framework for peace. As I say, there is a peace deal on the table that was there from 2006. I think there is a real sense that needs to be torn up and start again. But I think at this stage, it's too soon to talk about disarming militias.
OK, and how is this going to be enforced?
Well, there is a goodwill gesture at the moment by both sides that they're going to meet in 2 weeks' time. So we'll see in 2 weeks' time whether they do come around the negotiating table.
And that was a BBC's Karen Allen reporting for us from Nairobi in an interview that we conducted a little earlier on this morning. And Femi is here. She's got more news for us. Hello.
Hello there to you. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton signed an agreement in Japan today that will move 8,000 Marines off the Japanese island of Okinawa. They'll be redeployed to the US territory of Guam. And Clinton is on a tour of Asia, her first trip abroad as Secretary of State. President Obama will sign the $787 billion stimulus plan into law today. It will take place at Denver's Museum of Nature and Science, where the president will tour a solar panel installation. And the stimulus plan includes funding for new energy-saving technology. Australian police say the death toll from last week's bushfires is now at 200. Police say that number will go up as fire investigators continue their work. Thousands of other people were displaced by the fires, and police suspect that several were deliberately set, and they've charged one man with arson. A new report from the United Nations says that accidental civilian deaths caught in the line of fire in Afghanistan rose nearly 40% last year. Militants were responsible for most of those deaths, but the US, NATO and Afghan troops were responsible for many as well. And accidental civilian deaths tied to Western military operations have been a major source of friction between the US and Afghan President Hamid Karzai. South Carolina police say that they won't press charges against Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps because they don't have enough evidence. And this came after a photograph emerged several weeks ago showing him with a marijuana pipe or a bong. Phelps has apologized but hasn't admitted smoking. The U.S. body for competitive swimming suspended Phelps for 3 months after seeing the photograph. And Kellogg says that it wouldn't be renewing Phelps' endorsement contract. So that's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Picture doesn't count as evidence.
No, apparently not. But, I mean, why don't bongs and Rice Krispies go together? I don't understand. What's their position here? I don't really get it.
They don't. I don't see those two together.
Really?
Not even
snap, crackle,
pop.
All right, thank you, Femi.
Snap, crackle, pot. That works.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Markets open a little more than 2 minutes, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average takes a 2% plunge. We'll see what happens. It's a little early yet, but that's certainly based on a real downturn in the futures market. So let's talk about infrastructure. This is a good day for it. Barack Obama is signing the economic stimulus plan in Denver, a place that needs mass transit, a city that could benefit from mass transit. And it really sounds like a good idea. Let's take the Bay Area, for instance. It's a place where people spend a lot of time in their cars. But what if you could just forget your car and to go to the places that are across the bay or under the bay, North Bay, South Bay? You didn't have to get in your car. You could hop in a train, the BART train, and just ride without driving from place to place, say from the Mission District in downtown San Francisco to Oakland. What if you could do that? Well, you can do that. Of course, it sounds like a great idea, but in practice, mass transit systems around the country are having real serious problems. The infrastructure improvements envisioned by Barack Obama are not necessarily going to help anything. $8 billion this stimulus package is going to pump into rail systems. Local transportation agencies are in for a devastating year, though, because of budget shortfalls all around the country. And transit systems, regardless of the stimulus package, are going to be in real trouble. Is this stimulus package going to do anything to help systems like the BART system in San Francisco, which is, as we said, such a great idea? Rick Carr joins us. He's a correspondent for the Blueprint America Project at PBS. Rick, thanks for joining us there from the Bay Area.
You're quite welcome, John.
The BART system is a great system. It's certainly an ambitious transit system. But why is it not going to be helped by this stimulus package? And even if it was, why would that help not be enough given the problems?
Well, frankly, the stimulus package doesn't have a penny in it for operations at transit agencies. This is all about building stuff. And what officials at transit agencies across the country, including here in the Bay Area, have been telling me over the past few weeks is they're already getting crushed by a couple of different things. They're getting crushed by the fact that as gas went up to $4 a gallon, more and more people were riding transit. Why is that a problem? Well, let's talk about Muni here in San Francisco, where I'm sitting right now, the city system. To get on that train, I put $1.50 in the turnstile. It actually costs Muni about $6 to give me the ride.
That's a great business model.
Yeah, exactly. Well, make it up in volume, John. So as more and more people rode public transit, as gas hit about $4 a gallon, it was actually stressing the budgets more and more. Okay, so that's problem number one.
So success is failure.
Exactly, in this case. Problem number two is that all of the funding models for public transit across the country are kind of falling apart. New York City, there where I normally live, where you are right now, it's a real estate transaction tax that pumps a lot of money into the MTA, the system there. Well, the real estate market's not doing that well right now, so there's not a lot of money flowing into that. Here in the Bay Area, it's parking tickets and traffic tickets. Well, tourism's way down, which means there are fewer people making boneheaded moves on the streets and getting traffic tickets written. So everybody's revenue is down.
Talking about boneheaded moves, I mean, why would you even set up a transit system that would be dependent upon traffic use to fund it? Here is California State Senator Marc Desaulniers talking about how when the transit system doesn't work properly, it's a ripple effect in the entire regional economy.
The ability to connect to the whole infrastructure impacts everything. So if you can't get your bus from Richmond to the Richmond BART station, you're not going to take the whole trip. And then people can't access jobs, they can't access continuing education. It has a ripple effect that, from a financial standpoint, it's stupid to do what we're doing, not to mention the moral aspect.
What is the moral aspect there, Rick Carr?
Well, what Mark was talking to me about was that you've got these people who are most vulnerable. I mean, we talked to a student who's studying at the City College of San Francisco who lives up in Contra Costa County. That's Mark Desaulniers' district. He's dependent on a bus system up there called Westcat to take him to BART, then to Muni in the city, which then in turn takes him to the City College of San Francisco. The kid's studying to be an EMT, right? If the Westcat bus system in Contra Costa County goes out of business, which it is somewhat likely to do over the course of the year because its financial problems are so bad, how is he going to get to his classes, okay? You know, he's changing jobs. He's got neighbors who are, you know, hanging on by their fingernails. The bottom line that Mark Desaulniers is talking about in that piece of tape is it's the most vulnerable people who are riding transit who are most likely to be affected if there are service cuts, which is pretty much the only way to solve these budget shortfalls.
And what does Westcat, the transit agency you just referred to, say about itself? Here's Charlie Anderson, general manager of that Contra Costa County Westcat system.
The real fear is next year. I think we're at the point now where we've actually removed the convenience of the system to the point where people who have a choice will not choose transit. So it's getting to the point where we're dismantling the system.
It's too expensive to keep. That's an outrage, Rick.
Yeah, it's even more stressful here in California, because what's going on is that, of course, as we just heard, the state is having this massive budget crisis. The
20,000 people laid off today. That's the story today.
Yeah. Exactly. And you can't, you know, the state legislature is not getting its act together to actually pass these subsidies through. Governor Schwarzenegger, part of his budget proposal has been to zero out funding for transit, so that, you know, gets go back to that model I talked about. That $4.50 that Muni has to make up when I put my $1.50 in the turnstile, they need another $4.50 to give me that ride. Most of that is state money, and what the state of California is saying is we're not going to give it to you next year, which is this is doomsday for a lot of transit agencies, and it's not just here in the Bay Area.
A financial dismantling. That's your story there, Rick, but it's being repeated in communities all over the United States. It's going to take a much greater level of cooperation between federal, state, and local governments to really think about the economics of mass transit. This stimulus package is not going to help. I'd like to thank our guest, Rick Carr, correspondent for PBS's Blueprint America Project. He joined us from San Francisco. And now Femi Oke has the headline.
Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Eight men accused of plotting to blow up transatlantic passenger flights are now on trial in London. The plot is the reason you can't take big bottles of liquid on airplanes anymore. Lawyers say that they were planning to smuggle bomb ingredients aboard disguised as soft drinks, and they were to be detonated in flight. All men say that they're innocent, and seven of the eight are undergoing a retrial. Today is the deadline for GM and Chrysler to give plans to the government on how they will pay back billions in loans. Chrysler is expected to confirm a proposed alliance with Italian carmaker Fiat. GM is expected to announce plans to cut thousands of jobs. The Obama administration will have 6 weeks to consider the plans. There's conflict between the factions of Zimbabwe's unity government just days after it started. A senior member of new Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's political party has been arrested for charges, including attempting to commit terrorism. Tsvangirai says that it's an attempt by long-ruling President Robert Mugabe's party to derail the new government. And the resignation of Japan's finance minister over allegations of drunkenness at the recent G7 meetings comes as a major embarrassment to Japan's prime minister. Prime Minister Taro Aso accepted the resignation, and the minister denies he was drunk. And on a more sober note, Taro Aso will be the first head of state to visit the White House on February the 24th.
Dow and S&P down 3% in the early going. Thank you, Femi.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal.
And I'm John Huckenberry. An anniversary and a bit of a milestone, or an update, you might call it. It's Kosovo's one-year birthday today. Well, that's absurd in one sense. The history of Kosovo goes back many, many centuries. But as an independent nation, independent from Yugoslavia, it turns 1 year old today. It was the seventh state to emerge from former Yugoslavia. And 1 year ago, a lot of skeptics didn't give much credit to the chances that Kosovo would have as a nation going it alone. Of course, the war that was fought over Kosovo back in the 90s, you may recall. Helen Fox joins us now, BBC correspondent in Pristina, where she joins us from. Helen, first of all, what are people thinking about this anniversary? And the skeptics were wrong in one sense, even if things aren't terribly rosy.
Well, John, there's a real carnival atmosphere here in Pristina. Thousands of ethnic Albanians are heading to the city centre, waving Kosovo's new flag. There's lots of banners saying happy birthday. Cars are going past, tooting their horns, also waving the flags of Kosovo, as well as flags from the EU and the US, because people feel very strongly allied and thankful to the EU and the US for their support in Kosovo's push for independence. But you're right, this is people here will have mixed emotions as they celebrate this moment. For while Kosovo's independence has been recognised by more than 50 countries and most of the EU, it still hasn't quite been recognised by as many countries as Kosovo would like, and crucially, Serbia and its close ally Russia still vehemently oppose Kosovo's independence declaration.
Is Kosovo's existence itself a complication in actually joining the EU as a full member? I mean, it would be probably too much to expect that that would happen in the first year, but that's got to be a goal of the people in Kosovo.
Yeah, this is a top priority for Kosovo, but it's something that's unlikely to happen for many years to come. This is what Kosovo is pushing towards. But you're right to raise questions about Kosovo's existence. Kosovo now has its own constitution, which says that the government of Kosovo, based here in Pristina, is in charge. But it's unable to exert its authority over the Serb-dominated parts of Kosovo. That makes up about a quarter of the territory. And essentially, those areas are controlled by Belgrade. That's where the Kosovo Serbs live. And they say that Kosovo is still part of Serbia. They look to Belgrade for control. And so this place enters its anniversary celebrations with question mark over what is Kosovo and what its independence has achieved.
And in connection with the Serb minority, I mean, there were these predictions that they would leave. I mean, what is their position? Are they sort of integrated into a much larger community, or are they sort of mainly living in Serb enclaves?
The majority of Kosovo Serbs are living in enclaves, and the nightmare scenario of many Kosovo Serbs leaving following independence hasn't happened. Many are living here, but they say that they are too scared to go to ethnic Albanian areas. And,
well, the nation,
and they will not be celebrating today.
The nation is 1 year old, but still divided, as Helen Fox points out, BBC correspondent in Pristina, Kosovo. Thank you, Helen.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal, and Femi Oke joins us now with the news headlines. Hello again.
Hello. 30 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. The most sweeping economic package in decades becomes law today when President Obama signs the $787 billion stimulus plan. The rescue plan is meant to reinvigorate the job market, consumer spending, and public optimism. North Korea and its rumoured long-range missile tests jumped to the top of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's agenda this morning.
The possible missile launch that North Korea is talking about would be very unhelpful in moving our relationship forward.
During her first overseas trip, Clinton warned Pyongyang that the test could damage prospects for improved relations. The chief of a Cambodian prison where some 16,000 were tortured and killed begins his trial today. Gungik Yo ran a prison for the Khmer Rouge. He's appearing before a Cambodian genocide tribunal in its first proceedings on the Khmer Rouge. Some 1.7 million people died during their reign in the late 1970s. The government of Sudan and the most active rebel movement in Darfur have signed an agreement that could be the beginning of ending the conflict that's left some 300,000 people dead in the Darfur region of Sudan. The Sudanese government and the Justice and Equality Movement reached the deal in Qatar. And with the state of the economy issue number one at the moment, our partners, the BBC, have been talking to a high-profile Republican who's better known for his acting and directing than his political punditry. Clint Eastwood, though, wasn't shy about doing some recession prognosticating.
Whenever you spend like drunken sailors, eventually you've got to sober up. And we're in a sobering position right now, so I guess that'll last for a few years, and then we'll be back drunk again.
Clint Eastwood on the economy.
And he feels lucky. Thank you, Femi.
Thank you, Femi. And talking about the economy, it is clear that we are in a mess. But when you add terms like toxic assets and commercial paper and they become part of your everyday language, it is not surprising that the chain of events that got us to this place remain a source of confusion for many of us. And now a new Frontline documentary called Inside the Meltdown by filmmaker Michael Kirk puts the pieces of the fractured economy's puzzle back together again. Good morning to you, Michael.
Good morning, Dodie.
Michael, where did you choose to start your narrative?
It seemed to me, as always, the narrative should begin at the most striking moment and then go backwards and inform that moment and go forward and take the crystal ball out and talk about the future. So the moment that I found most stunning was a meeting in Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi's office on September 18th, just last fall, where the leaders of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, and Henry Paulson, the Secretary of Treasury of the Treasury, sat around a table in the early evening, and Paulson and Bernanke told the assembled congressional leaders that the economy was virtually melting down before their very eyes. They were told, the Congress was told that Paulson needed $700 billion as fast as possible. He had a three-page bill, proposal that had no judicial or congressional oversight provisions, and essentially said, you know, you got to give it to us or there will be no economy on Monday.
And talking of that meeting.
It was obviously a big meeting. I had no idea I was going to hear what I heard. We turned it right over to Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson.
And they said they needed authority to use $700 billion to unstop the credit markets.
And sitting in that room with Hank Paulson saying to us in a very measured tones, no hyperbole, no excessive adjectives, that unless you act, the financial system of this country and the world will melt down in a matter of days.
Wow. That's Senator Chris Dodd and Barney Frank. Of course, they've been on this program. I mean, that was the meeting where Paulson said, make me the boss and give me the money.
Yeah. Well, Michael, did any of these guys, Paulson, Bernanke, did they have any idea about what was going on and how they were going to fix it?
They had been one of the things we discussed. I'm not a financial journalist, so I don't know all the ins and outs of everything. I'm a political reporter. I've been doing it for 30 plus years. So I sort of know, you know, how things happen behind closed doors in Washington. The fact is, I think Bernanke and Paulson had been kind of making it up as they go against a kind of crisis mentality that
on the fly.
I think so, and I think the frightening thing for me as a journalist at the end of the process was to sit there and actually realize or come to the realization that they really didn't know how bad it was going to be as it was happening, and maybe none of us did, and they certainly didn't know what to do about it. And I have the feeling we still don't.
And you chose to tell this story like a political thriller. Why did you want to do it that way?
Well, in the first place, I think there's been lots of complicated and in some cases less than complicated, frighteningly less than complicated reporting going on about it. So I think people were a bit mystified and a little worried, and issues like executive pay, as important as those are, didn't seem to be getting at the heart of it. Certainly not on broadcast television. So, and I'm a narrative filmmaker. Character-driven narratives are my thing. I love it. I love to worry about characters, and certainly Hank Paulson is a Shakespearean character, if ever there was one. So we decided to tell it as a story, and it's partly because as I read the research from the Bear Stearns collapse in the spring, not even a year ago, Bear Stearns was collapsing, and as I read it hour by hour, day by day, of what happened in the flash of an eye when a huge corporation like that can go down, my heart quickened and I said, geez, I have to figure out a way to tell this story in a way where the viewer has the same reaction that I had looking at the research.
Although it's got to be a challenge for a filmmaker. I mean, unlike a political thriller where you kind of get to the bottom of it. I mean, this is a thriller where at the end of the day, it's, you know, we don't know. That's a challenge.
That's absolutely right, John. And it in some ways, knowing how scared everybody was in that meeting, the first scene in the film, allowed us to go backwards and see how they got to the moment where Paulson, a free trader, a best government is no government, a veteran of Wall Street, could find himself making the journey to the most interventionist Secretary of Treasury since the Great Depression. That character arc, if you'll excuse the vernacular of filmmaking, and storytelling is made to order no matter what happens. But of course, something really important happens. Hank Paulson, the reluctant Secretary of Treasury of the Bush administration, has just inserted the federal government into all of the major banks in America and into the lives of virtually every American citizen.
Michael, what were some of the challenges that you faced when you were trying to make this documentary? I know that you didn't actually have that much of a turnaround time to do it.
We did it in 20 weeks, which, you know, this year I made a 4.5-hour film called Bush's War in the Spring, which we had obviously a little more time to make, and we had made 11 films about the war. This is my kind of maiden voyage into the world of high finance and economics. But in a way, the story was already, it kind of told itself, which was fantastic, sitting in the editing room, feeling it go together so well. It wanted to tell itself. There were people who were eager to talk to us about what happened, and some, like Paulson and Bernanke, who for obvious reasons were not. Yes, it was a quick turnaround, but as I say, it kind of made itself because the story was a story.
And it airs tonight, right?
It airs tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern and at various times across the country.
All right. Michael Kirk, thank you very much. That's Michael joining us from our partners WGBH in Boston, and his frontline documentary Inside the Meltdown airs tonight. Sounds like a good watch. What do you think?
He sounds a little gleeful about the meltdown. They told their story to me.
Well, you got to ham it up. You want people to watch, right?
Yeah,
ratings rule.
He's a good salesman there. I'm sure it'll be great. We're talking about GPS technology and cell phones today. Do you feel like you're being watched? Well, you are. Satellites are watching you. But ZB, one of our listeners, doesn't think it's a great idea. He writes in an email, regardless of all the humorous answer you've been getting, does anyone realize the level of dumbing down that an over-reliance on gimmicky technology brings? I don't know. So is there any way you think tracking people might be good for society and for you? Let us know what you want GPS phones to do for you. You can go to our website, thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can take our podcast to go to catch anything you missed, like Michael Kirk's great interview with Daljeet there. And here's your takeaway.
The last thing empires do is drive themselves into bankruptcy. And it's happened to empire after empire. It's happened to king after king.
There's another podcast candidate that's Juan Enriquez talking about in our outtake segment, the real mathematics in this global economic meltdown.
I'm Daljeet Dhaliwal. See you tomorrow.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.